table went like this. Can you hear me? What was it? There was some advertisement in America some years ago for Verizon telephones, and the guy was going around all the time testing whether you could hear him. He said, "Can you hear me?" Did anyone ever see that? To see if the network was working. So, how are you feeling? So, tonight's the second night of our class, of second of four classes on Lodic, how we know what we know, the ways of knowing. And we're going to begin, as we did before, with a little meditation, practicing. So what we're going to be using is one part of the mind watching the rest of the mind, like someone at a... what's a good example in Singapore? I don't know, like at a cafe or something, watching the other people, which are kind of like the thoughts within your mind, but starting to let go of your apprehension of the thoughts, and at first seeing if you can get a little bit of a quiet mind, and the way that quiet mind arises is simply by turning your attention inside and not he's quite big. Yeah, you should move. Yeah. He's blocking your view. She had a good straight view, and then you sat down and said, okay. So as you turn your attention to the mind itself rather than to the senses, to just the mental consciousness. And you make a certain determination not to get involved with the thoughts that are there, sort of to withdraw from watching the thoughts, thinking about them, getting involved in them, and so forth. The mind begins to calm a little bit, and the frequency of thoughts and the intensity, let's say even the intensity of the thoughts, diminishes first of all, sort of like how brightly they're shining toward you, and the frequency in which new ones arise begins to slow down. So you can begin to see occasionally a little space between the thoughts. There might be some major thought that's bothering you, and that don't pay attention to that begins to fade away. You get a quiet moment until another thought comes. So you can begin to get an intuition of some space of the mind. See if you can hold that. Also, another strategy you could use, I mentioned last time, I think, is as though you're turning your attention away from focusing on the thought and sort of looking backward at the subjective mind. So letting go of you can say to yourself, let go of the objective thoughts, defocus on that and refocus on the subjective mind to which they're appearing. So it's not as though there's that dichotomy that the subjective mind is back here somewhere and the thoughts are out there. Where the thoughts are, there is the subjective mind, but you're just defocusing on that, on the objective thoughts, and seeing if you can to have some apprehension of the nature of the mind to which those thoughts are arising. It's clear, it's non-obstructing, because the thoughts can come and go without any hindrance. And consciousness that you're trying to apprehend, one part of the mind watching the rest of the mind, also has the quality of knowing. It's something that you can only know by experiencing it, what it means to know, right? A clear crystal might, like the mind, take on the aspect of whatever you place it over. You place the crystal, big crystal, clear crystal, on top of this rosary, and you can see an image of the rosary within the crystal, sort of like seeing through the crystal. So that's clear, but that's not the same as the clarity of the mind. But still, it's a kind of clarity. But the mind has this other quality of knowing. The crystal doesn't know the object that is reflecting in it, that is clearly appearing within it, right? So that is, first of all, the object that we're going to use to try to concentrate the mind. So you might want to start with watching your respiration for a few times. This is a grosser meditation because the object is easily found. The object is the inhalation and exhalation. That is to say, the object being easily found means it's not difficult. You don't have to sort of conjure up through this laborious path to see the clarity of the mind. That's your ultimate object. That's much more subtle. Here, at first, easy to find. So beginning, maybe watch your breathing for 7 respirations. Count. That is an in and out, counting as 1, and the next in and out is 2. And be like the proverbial Swiss school teacher. I don't know, I have this idea, Swiss school teacher is very strict. Maybe Singapore school teacher is very strict also. If you lose count, or if you forget whether you're breathing in or out, go back to 1. So once you've reached 7 respirations, then begin to watch the clarity of the mind. You're still watching the breathing. Make a mental note of the subtlety of it. How gross or subtle it is. And then bring your attention to the mental consciousness. See if you can notice what you're thinking, the thoughts that are sometimes always there, continuum of inner conversation, but we're not necessarily aware of. Judgments, feelings. As we saw last time, when we talked about the divisions of impermanent things, impermanent phenomena, there was matter, consciousness, and that which was neither. So consciousness is considered something which is immaterial. So it's non-obstructing. It's our inner resource. It's clear spaciousness of the mind. Even if a lot of thoughts are arising, or a few images, just at that moment you can recognize that those thoughts could not be present unless there was a spaciousness of the mind. And it's so even watching the thoughts themselves at that moment, just as you're watching the thought, recognizing the thought could not be there unless there was a spaciousness of the mind within which this thought was arising, you are, by focusing on the spaciousness, you are defocusing on the objective thought, refocusing on that quality of the mind that's also cognizant of the thought. You reach the point where you feel that you're starting to get a sense of that spaciousness. Perhaps notice that there is still present in your awareness a sense of your body, the body presence. That too is being perceived by your mental consciousness, who is like the guard in the basement watching the input from the five senses. So this would be the tactile sense that's knowing the body. Let go of that. Whenever it seems to be present, remind yourself that it's appearing to your mental consciousness in the spaciousness of your mind, and its very presence indicates that at that location, at that space, there is the factor of mind, the clarity of mind within which it's arising, non-obstructing, immaterial, and knowing. It's not going to disappear immediately, but by successively applying that thought process, let go of the letting go of your apprehension of the body consciousness, it begins to fade. In the end, also, there's a sense of the I watching, experiencing this, this sense of an independent observer who's kind of the owner of the mental consciousness. Think to yourself, that too is just a thought. It's appearing to my mental consciousness, the ego, the self. Where it's appearing, there is spaciousness of the mind. Refocus on that, that clarity and spaciousness and knowing, the quality of knowing at that space. Let go again and again of the thoughts of the body. Let go again and again of the apprehension of the self. And refocus on the subjective mind to which all of these are appearing. His Holiness the Dalai Lama said that this conventional clear light nature of the mind could be considered to be an instance of the conventional or developmental Buddha nature, let's say our conventional Buddha nature. Ultimate Buddha nature is the emptiness of the mind. This conventional Buddha nature is just this clear light nature. It's a great resource within which we can develop all the good qualities. We can eliminate all the faults, all of our self, deprecating minds that thinks I'm incapable. We can let go of our arrogant mind, our snarky mind that finds faults with others. And in place of these, we can develop compassion, empathy, love. With a life as a human right now, what we call a life of leisure and endowment, which we have most all of, if not everything, we can use this fact that we have this basic Buddha nature to use this life to not be involved in the meaningless activities of this life. I think I'm going to, in the next hour and a half, 2 hours, I'm going to participate in the class, thinking, observing, trying to utilize the medicine of the Dharma to heal myself in a fundamental way. To become less problematic for others, to be less a problem to myself. And to develop having eliminated the faults or reduced them as much as I can, to start to develop good qualities, opening our vista to concern for others. Developing a desire to escape from cyclic existence, and then to go beyond that, to think of the Bodhisattva's ideal, to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all living beings. That's the motivation behind all of the Bodhisattva activities. So think, if you can, I'm going to participate tonight for that purpose, to taking as my object, my aim, to achieve enlightenment for the sake of others, to participate in these various activities, virtuous activities, such as listening to the Dharma, contemplating it, and meditating on it. That's the reason I'm going to participate tonight. And then slowly bring your attention back to the present. Okay. How was your meditation? Any different than last time? Progression from last time or worse than last time? Worse? Oh, better. Okay. It's a good observation, because although we may have some dips, you know, it's usually getting a little bit better, a little bit easier. Just like with any activity, if you're practicing your golf swing, do you play golf? Used to? Some handouts? Come again? Oh, okay. So, why should we be concerned about developing the mind like this? Well, all of the positive qualities that we develop basically depend upon the mind: compassion, wisdom, renunciation, and so forth. Say, for instance, if we want to accumulate merit, we can make offerings to the imagined Buddha in front. Does that accumulate any merit? Because you can make water offerings. Even if you don't make water offerings, or flour, or light, or incense offerings, you can still imagine offering. Does that accumulate any merit? Oh, okay, good. My teacher Geshe Zopa mentioned in his commentary on the Lanrim Chemo that actually it takes a very special state of mind to have this faith that the omniscient mind exists, and as we with a mind of your own mind of faith, making offerings, whether they be physically prepared or just even mentally created, imagine goddesses coming from your heart offering to the Buddha, that the omniscient mind is aware of that. The omniscient mind experiences your imagined offerings with great bliss. and you accumulate merit. Experiences, the omniscient mind experiences them with great bliss and the apprehension of their lack of inherent existence, realizing they're empty of inherent existence, that combination. And from your side, if you can also imagine how the Buddha is experiencing them, you accumulate even greater merit. You know, imagine the water that you offer for drinking, for bathing, the flowers, the incense, the lamps, the perfume, food, music, and so forth, all these various kinds of offerings, and others, all of them experienced by the Buddha's mind with great bliss. To be able to imagine that great bliss, imagine what the Buddha's experiencing, you need a certain amount of apprehension of that great bliss. The more that you have experienced in your own meditation, the sutra and the tantra path, understanding of emptiness and this what's called sahaja bliss, this innate or conate bliss that we can develop in our own mind, not based on the actual object. You know, generally we only feel bliss when you eat the popcorn or the durian or the this basic kind of blissful state of mind that can be developed. So to develop these various abilities to know emptiness, to experience that bliss, we have to depend upon the mind. So that's why we find this kind of study is very, very important. To get get a clearer and clearer understanding. Okay. So last time we had mentioned, for instance, that the mental consciousness, unlike the sense consciousnesses, it apprehends its objects independence upon what's called the mental sense power. Do you remember what we were talking? So the mental sense power, from a Buddhist perspective, is not the brain. It's nothing material. The mental sense power is the previous moment of mental consciousness that acts as a support for the next moment of mental consciousness. That previous moment of consciousness has a dual purpose. It acts as the source of the continuity of the mind, and it acts as what's called the mental sense power. So that's where that's about where we had finished last time, right? So if you take the five senses and their sense powers, and then you take the sixth consciousness and its sense power, which is a previous moment of consciousness, how many do you have altogether? You have 12, right? Six senses and six objects. Those are called the 12 entrances. Or do you know the Indian word for that, Sanskrit word? Ayatanas. So if you add to those 12 the six objects of those, so you have six consciousnesses, the six sense bases for them, and their six objects, you end up with what are called the 18 spheres or 18 dhatus. I think that's maybe we had gotten up to that point last time. Remember I said the exclusive sphere, the exclusive objects of the mental consciousness are what are called dharma dhatu. Do you remember mentioning that about that? The dharma dhatu. And that sometimes, because the mental consciousness can know forms, visual forms, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, it can know many other mental objects such as impermanence and so forth, but it's kind of very special, exclusive mental object is the ultimate nature of phenomena, their emptiness. So sometimes emptiness is called dharma dhatu, sometimes it's a synonym, although technically speaking dharma dhatu includes all the sphere, all of the things that mental consciousness can know, all of them are included in the dharma dhatu. Generally, dharma dhatu is just those things that mind knows exclusively. So even though it can know visual forms and sounds, they're not generally considered part of dharma dhatu. Okay. So I was just amused when I said the sixth sense is the mental consciousness, because generally people don't think of it as the sixth sense, do they? Do you remember a movie some years ago called The Sixth Sense? Who was in it? There was, I think, Bruce Willis and this little boy who's become now older, Osmond or something. He was a little boy. Do you remember, any of you not heard of that? You saw that movie? So it's almost as like the sixth, he had some sixth sense, you know, almost as though the only thing that the ordinary world considers are the five senses. It almost is oblivious of the fact that the mental consciousness is constantly, always there. It's not something special, you know, that perceives spirits or something like that, right? Okay. So what is this nice thing that's being passed around? Can I get a copy? I'm jealous. Oh, okay, good. Thank you. Good. Okay, so the text that we're using as a basis, which is basically all of these, the texts that teach the same subject will cover the same subjects, but the same topics, but from different points of view, with different order and so forth. So generally, when we talk about something, it starts with awareness, doesn't it? Types of awareness. So even before talking about awareness, before talking about consciousness, we can say that there are two kinds of things, subjects and objects. Okay? Subjects and objects. In general, things that have objects, that is to say subjects, so subjects are things that are said to have objects. What kind of things are subjects? We've been talking sometime about the subjective mind, right? Like when we're talking about the mental consciousness. It is said to have objects in that objects appear to it and it knows them. And so that intimate relationship between the mind and the objects that it's knowing qualifies mind to be a subject. Can mind be an object? Yeah, because one part of our mind is not only watching the mind as an object, is watching the contents of the mind, but also watching the object of the mind itself as an object. So in that case, this main mind that we're watching is the object, and the little part of the mind that's watching it is the subject mind. this mind itself is a subject. It's knowing objects. And there are other kinds of subjects. When we talked about the impermanent phenomena, remember what the three kinds of impermanent phenomena were? I can't, you have to say it louder. Yeah, you. Push out. Did she say right? I can't hear her. She's too shy. You should have that microphone with you if you're going to help out. What is it? Form, consciousness, and non-associated factors. That which is neither. Yeah. Oh, she's fitting.
Neither form or neither form nor consciousness. Yeah.
So each one of those categories have examples of subjects. Subjects can be a material. What kind of forms are said to be subjects? Well, one of the main categories is what are called articulate sound. Remember, we said that sounds, the object is the object of ear consciousness, right? So some sounds do not necessarily indicate some particular, you know, volitional transmission of information. You know, just the banging of the workers on the street as you go down the street, or the dripping of the water on your roof. They don't necessarily articulate something. But there are some sounds that are created via human or by the omniscient mind, like in the Pure Lands. Even the wafting of the trees, the sound from the trees, actually imparts some kind of meaning to us. But in general, the trees that we hear, the leaves whooshing and so forth, they don't necessarily impart any meaning. But our speech, you know, the sound that you're listening to now, even though I'm a dumb, just a dumb sentient being, there's some volition on my part to impart some meaning to the words because you've trained in them. Those sounds are called articulate sounds, and they are called subjects because they hold a particular meaning. Okay, they have particular meanings. Also, you know, I'll read this, what Geshe Darge's commentary says. All spoken words signify something. Okay, so this, the object to which the individual words are referring are their objects. So those are called, that's one category of subjects. And in fact, in Buddhism, there's a lot of study of that because how we transmit knowledge is through sound. Whether the sound is naturally, whether a particular word has a natural relationship with its objects or it's something that is adventitious and so forth, all of this is investigated. Right now, we're just to know that that's one of the categories. Consciousnesses, the second category of that. If you talk about these three kinds of impermanent things, those are what we've been talking about. They have their own objects, those things that they're apprehending. What about if you just have no thoughts at all? You know, like I said, many people say, you know, they, when I try to, when I'm given the task of trying to teach about meditation and talking about all these things that we want to try to cultivate in our mind, they think, oh, I thought meditation was just having no thoughts. Have you heard that? And, you know, many times people believe that's what meditation, especially in the popular world, having no thoughts, sitting like zombie-like or something. Even then, if the consciousness is aware of itself, if it's aware of anything, it has an object. Even trying to hold it in that state of having no objects, it has a subtler and subtler kind of object, like in the form and formless realms, like infinite space, or even the concept of nothing at all is one of the highest kinds of subtlest kind of objects within cyclic existence that one can meditate on, other than subtle objects such as impermanence and emptiness. And then, so then the third category, the non-associated factors, non-associated compositional factors, they're called that because they're not associated with mind, and they're also not associated with matter, but there are compositional factors, they're impermanent. So the example of a compositional factor which is a subject is the person. Okay. What's your name? Jana? What?
Jordan.
Jordan. So Jordan is a person, right? What? Yeah. He defensively says, in case you think he's a pillar or something like that. So persons have objects because the person Jordan has a consciousness, the person Jordan has a body, the person Jordan has qualities and maybe a couple of faults, maybe not many. The person Jordan has clothes and obviously a pair of glasses. And so the persons are an example of something which is neither material nor consciousness, which is a subject. Okay, and that'll come up again and again, because sometimes in your own meditation, just in the meditation we did before, I said, you know, once you've let go a little bit of the thoughts within your mind that are coming up, you might still have the sense of your body there, physical form. Let go of that. And then to let go of even the sense of self, the sense of Jordan or the sense of Cecilia or whatever your name is, you know. Okay. So the definition or the defining characteristic of a way of knowing is awareness. We're talking about these various ways of knowing, seven ways of knowing. They all are basic characteristic is being in awareness. To know, to cognize, to be aware. These are three Tibetan words: sheba, rikpa, lo. And to have a clear experience of something are all mutually exclusive terms. They're synonyms. Mutually inclusive is a more complicated way. I prefer to say they're synonyms. So for two things to be synonyms, the text goes on to mention something that we'll come up with in the future also. For your logical understanding, there have to be eight sets of congruences, eight sense of similarities between them. Let's say for what's the Chinese word for dog? What is it? Chinese word for dog. The bark bark. Whoa. Po. Oh. Like K-H-O? G-O-U. Go. Go. I won't learn Chinese this life, I don't think. Maybe. I know a couple of Chinese words. Sifu. Sifu means teacher. As I've heard people say, oh, Sifu, Sifu. A couple of Chinese words. And Qi for the energy current and so forth. So, Go. So, Go. Correct me. Go. Go and dog. Are they synonyms? Are they synonymous? What did you said yes in Chinese or what? So yes. So how do we tell if two things are synonyms? So these are the eight things. If you consider two things, the text uses X and Y. Let's use A and B. Okay. If something is A, if A and B are synonyms, if it's A, it has to be B. And if it's B, it has to be A. So does that work with dog and go? If it is go, it is dog? Yeah. If it is dog, it is go? Yeah, right? If you have A, you have B. Is it other set? If you have B, you have A. If you have go, there's a go here. Yeah, I have a go, you have a dog. If you have a dog, you have a go. Yeah, right. And also the opposites of those. If it is not A, it is not B. If it is not go, is there anything which is not go but is still a dog? No. If it's not a dog, it's not go, and so forth. And so on. If you don't have a dog, if you don't have go, you don't have a dog. If you don't have a dog, you don't have go. So those are called the eight similarities of synonyms. For two things to be synonymous, they have to have that kind of relationship. So here's an example the text gives us, something which are not synonymous. How about a mug and being impermanent, or let's say impermanent. Is the mug impermanent? What do you think? Is the mug impermanent? Sir? Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Is the mug impermanent? Yes. So you might think mug and impermanent are synonyms. Are they synonyms? Well, if it is a mug, let's say mug and A and B are mug and impermanent. So if it is a mug, is it impermanent? Yes, that first one. Now, if it is impermanent, is it a mug? No, not everything impermanent is a mug. All of these things are impermanent, you know. It's the jasmine leaves and, you know, you yourselves. So it fails very quickly. How about, that which arises from causes, which is another word we use for that is product. I'm not sure in your classes. Say product and impermanence. Are they synonymous? Are they synonyms? What do you think? You seem to be on the ball here. Are they synonyms? Think so. Okay. Not absolutely 100% sure. Who thinks they're not synonyms? Like I said, mug and impermanence are not synonymous. They're not synonyms, right? Although they might think. What do you think? I thought you. Oh, you were just. Oh. Okay. Yes. Anyone have an idea? So let's check. If it is a So we say product and impermanence are A and B. So if it's a product, is it impermanent? If it is impermanent, is it a product? No, okay. Give me an example of something which is impermanent but is not a product. Not the product of causes and conditions. She's thinking. That little clock on the TV. Ding! So, generally, anything which is impermanent has to have arisen from some cause. Maybe its previous moment of existence. Even say, these flowers had their cause in the seed a long time ago, but they had their immediate cause, when they were on the tree. And they have their immediate cause right now, moment by moment, every moment of the little jasmine bud here arises from the previous moment of the jasmine bud. Remember when we talked about impermanence, maybe it was in one of the other classes, that the reason we don't recognize things as being impermanent is because what arises the next moment is so similar to what was there the previous moment. If you were to sit here for a long, long time and watch them, they would turn, wouldn't they sort of turn brownish, reddish brown or something, maybe the initial nice fragrance of them might turn a little bit unpleasant. One great Thai teacher, Thai guru, Achan Cha. Did anybody ever encounter Achan Cha? I think he died some years ago. He had a lot of Western disciples, a Thai monk, forest monk. He came once to our monastery in England, our center in England called Manjushri Institute when I was there, gave a course, and Venerable Semedo, who is, I think, still teaching around the world, was his translator. And during the course, he asked us to pick the very best flower out of the garden. We had the gardener. He reluctantly cut the very nicest flower and put it in the tea room where everyone would come every day again and again for tea. And there was a room also next to the dining room, so you'd pass. To put it in a bowl of sand and to watch it. You know, at first it looked still glistening, you know, little beads of moisture on the surface of the leaves. Everything was pristine. But then after the very first tea break, you know, a couple hours later, you came back and a little, just the glow of the, that moisture on the surface was a little less intense. Maybe the next time some of the edges of the leaves looked a little bit frayed. Can you imagine the next day, the next day, the next day? I think he was there for 2 or 3 days. It started to, little spots began to appear in it. And after a while, it no longer smelled fragrant, but actually, you know, a little bit unpleasant, and you wanted to throw it away. So we didn't notice that from the beginning. And that's one of the classic examples also of meditating to overcome attachment, say, to the body of someone else that you might be attracted to, or to even your own body. It eventually, you know, is going to decay like this. It's going to age and so forth. It's impermanent. So everything arises from the previous moment. So if it is impermanent, it's necessarily a product. So if you have a product, do you have something which is impermanent? Yeah. If you have something which is impermanent, do you have a product? Yeah. If it is not a product, is it not impermanent? If it's not arisen from causes and conditions, is it not impermanent? No? You don't think so? So if it's not a product, if it's not arisen from causes and conditions, it can still be impermanent? No, it has to be impermanent. So if it's not a if it is not a product, that is something like space, it is not impermanent. That's true. So it has that. If it's not impermanent, it's not a product. If you don't have a product, you don't have something which is impermanent and so forth. So that passes the synonym test. Product and impermanent are synonyms, which is surprising because we're going to talk a little bit later, hopefully, if there's enough time. One of the classic examples to prove, or one of the classic logical arguments to prove impermanence is something like this. The subject sound, what's the subject, is impermanent. It's kind of like the sound is impermanent. That's kind of the thesis. Because it's a product. So we're using, even though we're trying to prove that sound is impermanent because it's a product. Even though product and sound are synonyms, you might think, oh, that can't work. That's not, how can you prove something is, you know, sound is something by using a synonym of that thing? If you don't understand it's impermanent, could you still understand it's a product? Here's an interesting thing. Even though they're synonyms, sometimes because of the way that they are presented to the mind, one is more easily understood. We can understand that sound is a product of causes and conditions. Someone can take a gong and dong, you know, before they create the cause, you know, the causes and conditions of hitting the gong, there's no sound. But when they do that, the sound comes and you say, oh yeah, sound is a product. Sound is a product of causes and conditions. You can't get sounds unless something, there's some causes and conditions that create them. But we don't, but our minds are sometimes more obscure to the fact that that means that they are impermanent. So it's a very interesting thing for you to investigate. Even though we may use various synonyms, and maybe when teachers give a lecture, to, you know, teaching some subject, they may say the same thing in different, using different words. You know, oh, it's this. It's, you know, it's impermanence. It's a product. This. Some of those may resonate with your mind more than others. So it's useful to know language, to know various words to express. Okay. So these are also called the eight pervasions. Not perversions. The eight pervasions. So a pervasion means if it is A, it is necessarily B. That's a pervasion. So these are eight pervasions. If it is A, it is necessarily B. If it is B, it is necessarily A, and so forth. All vases are impermanent, but not all impermanent things. The text has a mistake here. Not all impermanent things are vases. The text says, but not all impermanent things are not vases. It should say, not all impermanent things are vases. Okay, so then the text goes on to say, there are different ways of dividing up ways of knowing. I mentioned in one of the other classes, I use this example a lot. And maybe because I like, well, before my ketogenic diet, one of my favorite things is pizza. Do you like pizza here? Is this, even in Singapore? Is there a particular kind of Singapore pizza? I remember when I came back from the States one time, after having been in Nepal, been a monk for some time, and came back and my friends had ordered Hawaiian pizza with pineapple on it. And I thought, oh, this was this was heresy. Maybe. Do they put durian on pizza here? Yeah? Oh, my gosh. Ken? You can speak some Singlish. Ken? Yeah, Ken. So if you divide the pizza, the classic way in a lot of places is you cut it four times or five times or whatever, and you get these triangular kind of ways. This can cut it up. Or you can cut it rectangularly, sideways, so the pieces are square or, you know, somewhat rectangular or square. You can cut it up different ways. In the same way, one subject can be dissected in many different ways. For instance, the ways of knowing can be divided into those things that ways of knowing which realize their object. This text translates it as apprehends, but I think the Tibetan word is topa. The same sound also can mean conception, but the way that this topa is spelled has a final syllable, s or sa, and it means to realize. So realization means that you have gotten to the core of something, you've understood it correctly, you've apprehended it in such a way that doubts and superimpositions are removed. So there's some kinds of ways of knowing that realize their objects, and other ways of knowing or experiencing something which don't realize their objects. Can you think of some way of knowing that doesn't realize its object? Well, we haven't really, we've talked a little bit, just in general. Oh, hey, actually, on this list, here we go. Non-cognizing consciousness. Oh, yeah. So this is supposed to be the same thing. Yeah. So it says awareness is divided into two. Cognizing consciousness, which is what we can call a realization, you know, a realizing consciousness, that which realizes its object, and non-cognizing consciousness. In other words, consciousness that does not realize its object. So, for instance, under non-cognizing consciousness, in this chart from Jeffrey Hopkins' book, does it say what page? So if anyone's listening to this on the... It's near the end of... it's chart number 41 of Jeffrey Hopkins, in Jeffrey Hopkins' book, Meditation on Emptiness. It's a very big book. So example of non-cognizing consciousness or a way of knowing that does not realize its object, correct assumption or presumption. Another way of translating it. So that means to presume something is true, but... not really having, maybe not having a reason, or even having a confused reason, maybe even having a wrong reason, presuming something is true, which happens to be true. You know, sometimes people are so proud of themselves, they say, "I knew it." You know, when they didn't really know it, they just were presuming it. They were presuming something was true, which happens to be true. That's called a correct assumption or correct presumption. How about doubt? Does that realize its object? No, it's an indecisive kind of mind. Wrong consciousness, such as having been impaired by jaundice. Your eyes may sense a yellow glow over things. There's no yellow glow there. And another kind of consciousness that we're going to talk about, inattentive perception, a consciousness to which an object appears but is not ascertained, such as you're watching the fireworks down on the, where was it? Down by that big hotel with the boat on the top. What is that called? The Marina? Marina Bay? Was there, were there fireworks this year and New Year's? I just crashed. Pardon? Chinatown. Okay. There wasn't in Marina Bay? Oh. No, I'm talking about the American New Year, Western New Year, January 31st. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, fireworks. You're watching the fireworks, or you're watching in Chinatown, Tibetan, Chinese New Year fireworks, whatever. And you're so concentrating on that that someone's telling you, let's go. Or here's something happening over here. Your ear consciousness hears that, but because your mental consciousness, remember the fellow in the basement, is paying attention to one of the sensors, the eye consciousness, is not paying attention to the ear consciousness. So later, you can't recall that you heard something. It doesn't in the sound that was said doesn't induce in your consciousness the ability to remember it. You don't know that you've heard it. You might just, you know, someone might have to knock you a couple times to get your attention away from the fireworks. Okay, all of those are examples of ways of knowing that are not, that don't realize their objects. How there are consciousnesses that do realize their objects. Interesting, yeah. There are ways of consciousness, the ways of knowing that do realize their consciousness, realize their objects, such as bare perception. You know, their eye, ear, nose, taste, touch, and also the mental consciousness can know things with bare perception. But as we talked about last time, bare perception, mental bare perception generally for us is limited to certain kinds of vivid dreams and very short instances, but it can be trained to realize emptiness directly. Have a bare, bare here means direct, you know, naked perception of something without any kind of interfering mental image. And a mental consciousness that has a mental image, but has arisen because of a correct logical reason is called an inferential cognizer. Inferential cognizer. Do you know what inference means? To infer something means to bring about an understanding of something through a logical reasoning. So even if you understand impermanence or emptiness through a correct reason, like sound is impermanent because it's a product. And because of that, you can understand that sound is impermanent. You can realize that sound is impermanent, even though you can't perceive that with any of the other senses. Okay, so we're going to continue on. So there are ways of knowing. You can divide ways of knowing into realizing and non-realizing consciousnesses. Also, you can divide it up into seven different ways. That's the main object of our text. Later, we'll talk among these seven. Well, we just gave an example here of how you can divide the seven into realizing and non-realizing. There's one that's left out here, though, right? One, two, three, four, five, six. One's missing. Because this is a particular reason, we'll see why. You can also divide consciousness into valid and invalid ways of knowing. That's what this chart is. Valid cognizers and invalid cognizers. Not all consciousnesses, not all the seven ways of knowing can be put into those two divisions, valid and invalid. We'll see why a little bit later. So you can, of the seven ways of knowing, you can apprehend, you can realize things through bare perception, inference, or also a third kind of consciousness called subsequent cognition. So here, what's the meaning of this? A subsequent cognition. So when we have a bare perception of something, let's say, we see something with our eye consciousness, there is an initial apprehension of that object, which then provides the impetus for us to know that, let's say, a shape and color, if we are looking at this. Shape and color is all that eye consciousness perceives. You could say it perceives the mug, but it doesn't know it's a mug. How do we know it's a mug? We know it with the mental consciousness, that particular shape and color. But the eye consciousness, the first instant of the eye consciousness is like a fresh cognition, which brings about an understanding of the shape and color, let's say. Then there are some, in that train of consciousness, there is a very short instant, maybe just countable number of thought instances that are induced by that. It's very fresh. And then the consciousness refreshes, so to speak, and might have another train of direct perception of that, starting with an initial moment. And then the secondary moments are sort of carried by that. A little bit like the first, what's it called, car of a train that pulls the rest of the cars is called the engine. Maybe sometimes in America here also, sometimes there's an engine at the back also. But let's assume this is a train with just an engine in the front. That engine is like the first instant of a perception. It pulls the subsequent instance of, say, eye consciousness. Those instances are also realized, but they're not fresh like the first instant that has some special power. So that first instant of a cognition is something which in the Sautrantika system is called pramana. Have you heard that word, pramana? What is it? Where have you heard that term? Pramana vartaka. So Pramanavarta Semanamdal is a commentary on pramana. One way of translating pramana is valid cognition, although it doesn't always, pramana can mean other things too, but like validity, that which is valid, you know, has a deep, you know, you can rely upon that because it's valid. According to the Sautrantika system, something which is valid, they take the etymology of pramana, and I think they take pra as meaning initial. So only the initial moment of a train of consciousness is valid. The subsequent moments still realize the object, but they're like the other cars of the train that are pulled by the engine. They realize their object, but they're not pramana. They're not valid. They're not, because they lack the characteristic of being fresh and initial, you know. The highest philosophical school, for those who you may have encountered, like the Prasangika, say, Nagarjuna and the great scholars that came, they take a different etymology of pramana. And they say that even the subsequent moments, even the what do we call this? Subsequent cognition are also valid. So in this chart that you have, when it's divided into realizing or valid, say valid cognizers and non-valid cognizers, here there's only six divisions altogether. You don't see subsequent cognition as being one of them, because it is not considered a valid cognition. Yet, it's not invalid either. It is a realizing cognition, but it's not a valid cognition. Okay. So now we're going to get into some more statements here. Some scholars say that correct assumption, when you don't have a correct reason, or maybe even you've got even a wrong reason, some people say that correct assumption is a way of knowing something which realizes its object. What is correct assumption? Correct assumption is the kind of state of mind that we mainly know now about the Dharma. When you hear about the Dharma, when you hear about emptiness or impermanence and so forth, or reincarnation, probably we have not realized that subject. We haven't realized the fact that we have a life of leisure and endowment. We haven't realized that products are impermanent. We haven't realized that we will have past and that we had past lives and will have future lives. We have, if we believe these things, we might have a correct belief or correct assumption or correct presumption about them. But they're not based on logic. We haven't realized them directly. That's why we want to study these subjects, to be able to understand them and to have certainty about them that's based on correct understanding. So what some people say that correct belief is another way of calling presumption or correct assumption. I kind of like correct belief just sounds more simple to me. Presumption is already sounding a bit, not part of my usual vocabulary. Some people like to make all of the words very philosophical for philosophers. I prefer to use it just for, more basic understanding. Correct belief, when you believe something which, and your belief happens to be correct, but it's not based on real sound reasoning, that doesn't really realize the object. When people say it is a kind of realization, they means it's the next step, it's the last step before having a realization is going to be a correct assumption, a correct belief. You can transform that correct belief into an inferential cognition, for instance, a realizing consciousness, something that knows its object by applying correct reasoning. That's why reasoning is considered to be very important in Buddhism. So, also you can, when you talk about knowing something, you can know things directly and you can know things indirectly. What that, the differentiation being, if you know something directly, the object that you're knowing actually appears to your consciousness. Let's say you see these blue cushions. So you are knowing blue, you're knowing that the cushion is blue directly. Indirectly, you are knowing that the cushion is not red. Are you knowing, does red appear to your consciousness when you see the blue cushion? No, obviously. But if someone were to ask you while you're looking at it, is it red? What would you say? No, because you know indirectly the fact that it is blue precludes the fact, excludes the fact, eliminates the possibility of it being red. Okay? You can have an indirect perception of something. Say, for instance, if you see some characteristic of a person, or say you hear their voice around the corner, and you know that person has arrived, even though you haven't seen the person, some characteristic of them, you see, or maybe you see their, you come into a room and you know there's someone there and they've left their, something that's character, their phone with their case, their phone case, or even the screen says their name on it, you know they are there. So indirectly, even though they don't appear to you, you know that they are there. Okay, I'm going to skip a little of this because it's a little more detail that we don't need right at the moment. We might go back to it later. Okay, so now we're going to get into the seven ways of knowing something are, in this text says presumption. What Jeffrey Hopkins' text here, what is that one? Correct assumption. I like to call it correct belief. That's the first one we're going to talk about. Correct belief or presumption, correct assumption. Inattentive perception, the second one. Here, Jeffrey's text says, a consciousness to which something appears but is not ascertained. That's the last here, appearing but not ascertained. Inattentive perception. The example I gave before of you watching the fireworks, and although sound is appearing to your ear consciousness, you don't ascertain that. You're not able later to recall that someone was. Even at the time, you're not paying attention to that sound. And later, you can't remember that you heard it. That's the second one. Then third one, the third way of knowing is called subsequent cognition. Here we talked about it, like the subsequent cars of a little train set. You know, the engine is the first instant, and all of the other instants in the train before the consciousness sort of dies off and is, you have another train of, say, visual consciousness or ear consciousness or whatever. Those subsequent moments are called subsequent cognition. Then, fourth, distorted cognition. What's that on this other chart here? Wrong consciousness. If you want to make note of these different... Wrong consciousness is what this text is, the Akio Yongzun text is calling distorted cognition. Wrong consciousness. Here it says indecisive wavering. Oh, that's like an Alex Berson term, indecisive wavering. What is that on this text? Doubt. I like that one. Very simple. Doubt. Doubt is a state of mind, you could say it's indecisive, wavers between two conclusions. It never comes to some, you know, maybe it's this, maybe it's that, I don't know. Maybe it's this, maybe it's that, it might be that, but it doesn't come to that state that we talked about before of presumption or correct belief. Remember, we said correct belief or presumption, assumption is sometimes said to realize its object in that it's just before realizing it you have a correct assumption. So correct assumption comes after having a doubt about something. When you analyze it, you get rid of that indecisive wavering and you understand it. You believe it's true, but you have not yet proved it to yourself. So what do we have? Correct belief, inattentive perception, subsequent cognition, wrong consciousness, doubt, those are five, bare perception or direct perception, which is one of the most important subjects that's studied, bare perception, how we know things directly or barely, nakedly. It doesn't mean you are naked, don't worry. It means when we say, do we use that kind of terminology in everyday conversation? Had a naked perception, direct perception, nothing intermediary between you, just you and the object. And the last one is inferential cognition, inferential understanding. So that means a mental consciousness. You don't have inferential understanding with your eye, ear, nose, taste, touch. You have it with your mental consciousness. And it precedes that inferential cognizer or inferential understanding is one that we have to understand what are called hidden phenomena. Remember we talked about hidden phenomena before? Did we talk about in this class hidden phenomena, or was it the other class? There are three kinds of phenomena. Those that present themselves directly to you, manifest phenomena, that you can see directly with bare perception. You don't need any logic to prove their existence. There are things that are hidden from our knowing, slightly hidden, such as impermanence and emptiness, that have to first be proved with a logical reason in order to understand them. Then later, by meditating on that and again, you can have a direct perception of them. And there's a third category of phenomena that are called the deeply hidden phenomena. Did we talk about that here, or was it the other class? We did. Deeply hidden. And the example of that was what? The particularities of karma, that this particular action, let's say, saying some harsh words to a person at this time, when and where that will ripen. That particular karmic relationship is deeply hidden. Only the omniscient mind is capable of knowing. Other qualities of karma we can know. Just the fact that being generous brings about the acquisition of possessions in the future, that the karmic repercussion of that will be that we will receive resources in the future, and that if you keep morality, that the karmic consequence of that will be, for instance, having a human form and so forth in the future. We can know those things. Those are not deeply hidden phenomena. They're hidden, but they're not deeply hidden. Deeply hidden phenomena. So these are the seven ways of knowing. Of these seven, only the last two, bare or direct perception and inferential cognition, only these two are valid. All the rest of them are invalid. Even according to this school, even subsequent cognition is not valid because it's not fresh. However, subsequent cognition does realize its object. Okay, so first thing, correct belief, the first of the seven ways that in this text, presumption or correct assumption. So correct belief is defined as an invalid way of knowing that takes its object, apprehends its object correctly, and cognizes that object freshly. It's something that you don't have with your eye consciousness. It's a conceptual state of mind. It's not valid. It doesn't It doesn't get to the gist of the object, but it takes something, it takes its object in a correct way, in a true way. If you have a valid way of knowing, such as direct perception or inference, you have a fresh understanding of something. Let's say if you talk about inference, you have a fresh conceptual understanding of something. Here, however, you have a fresh reaching of a correct conclusion, because even the second moment of a correct belief is like the first moment is the correct belief. The subsequent moments are subsequent cognitions of that. Here, however, you have a fresh reaching of a correct conclusion without really understanding it or knowing why it is true. With correct belief or presumption, you merely seem to understand or apprehend something freshly. We could leave off the freshly for the time being. Because what you know is true, but actually your knowledge of it is indecisive and invalid. You presume it to be true either for no reason, a wrong reason, or even by a right reason, but without understanding why it is correct. So there are five divisions of this correct belief. You can have a correct belief for no reason whatsoever. Someone might just say, sound is impermanent because it's a product. And you get, right. You didn't even, you know, you may have heard the reason, but you don't understand it at all. Or someone may just say, sound is impermanent, or that we have past and future lives, or all phenomena are empty of the true of inherent existence. And you go, right. He's my guru. She's my guru. Is that a valid way of knowing? Because your guru said that? Something to think about. We'll talk about that later. In general, just having read something or heard something, sometimes we jump to conclusions because it satisfies. A lot of that happens in politics. I know in the United States right now, people jump to conclusions. They hear someone did something and they immediately assume that's true. Would that necessarily be a correct belief? What would have to be correct belief? It would have to be true. You'd have to believe something which happened to be true, but if you have no reason for that, that would be called a correct belief. But it's very easy that you could, you happen to, because you have no reason, you could have believed something which was untrue. You know, that would be a wrong consciousness. So correct belief sometimes is just lucky. Do you know what I mean? You believe something that happens to be true. You believe something to be true and it happens to be true, but you don't... The first kind is for no reason at all. Okay? Second one is for a contradictory reason. For instance... To give an example of this, we have to understand some logic. So, generally, when we give a logical statement, there will be the subject, what's called the subject, the predicate. The second element is the predicate. The two of them together are kind of what you're trying to prove. You could call it the thesis, right? Sound, the subject. Is impermanent is the predicate of the logical argument. The reason is the third element that tries to connect the two. Sound is impermanent because it's a product. That's a correct logical statement, is a correct syllogism. Okay? Does that make sense? Does that make sense to you? Is it just blah blah blah? Are you following? This young lady. Are you, yeah? Is it making sense to you what I'm saying? Yes? No, I'm asking you, yeah. Yeah. Does it make sense? Okay. I'm not sure. I'm just saying a lot of words. So, generally when we try to prove something, say for instance, if you're going to have a correct belief, you might be using some kind of logical argument in your mind. What if you said, sound is impermanent because it's not a product of causes and conditions. Well, that wouldn't be true, right? You might be believing sound is impermanent, but for a contradictory reason. Actually, to be something which is not arisen from causes and conditions is contradictory to being impermanent. If you have that kind, and there's more subtle kinds of reasonings like that. So sound is impermanent because it's a product of causes. This is one of the most commonly used examples in Buddhist logic. Do you know why? Why that's often used? Have you heard that example before? Sound is impermanent because it's a product, means a product of causes and conditions. Why is that used? Because that particular logical statement is used to refute the non-Buddhist, the Vedic, the pre-Buddhist philosophical position that their scriptures and the knowledge, the words of those scriptures are eternal, and permanent. Because they are the revelations of super empirical truths without any author. So some of the Vedic positions are that the truth of the Vedas, that there was something permanent about the words. They were eternal. So to refute that, because those words are sound, you could say, no, that's not true. Sound is impermanent. It's not permanent because it's a product of causes and conditions. So that's why that particular logical statement, that syllogism, is very, very famed. Okay? In this case, sound is a subject, or the basis of the proposition. Being impermanent is the predicate, that which is to be proved about it. So the two of them together are the thesis. Sound is impermanent. The reason, or the line of reasoning, is the last thing, because it is a product. It is the product of causes and conditions. That's the sign or reason or line of reasoning that's used to prove it. Sound is impermanent because it's a product. Okay. The opposite of what is to be proved, what's the opposite of what is to be proved? What is to be proved in this case? Impermanence, right? What's the opposite of impermanence? Permanence. That's what you have to disprove. Not only you have to prove its impermanence, you have to prove that sound is impermanent, but you also have to disprove that it's permanent. It turns out, logically, if you prove something is impermanent, indirectly, you disprove that it's permanent. You prove that it is not permanent, right? So you don't have to prove that third element. You just have to prove that it is impermanent. So this opposite, permanence, and the subject taken together are the antithesis Sound is permanent. Everything to which what is to be proved applies, all impermanent phenomena. Okay, so here this is getting using terms here that's not so clear. So we'll leave that for the time being. To prove a thesis and disprove its antithesis, there are three factors that have to be established. There's something called the property of the subject. So what's the subject in that line of reasoning? Sound, right? Sound is a subject. Sound must be the reason must be a property of the subject. This is called the property of the subject. So sound is impermanent because it's a product. What's the reason? Being a product, right? Because you leave the word because off. It is a product. Sound is a product. Is that correct? You can try to make a logical statement in which there is not the relationship between the subject and the reason, that the subject does not have that reason, is not that reason. But in this case, this is a correct reason. This has what's called the property of the subject. So in a correct logical statement, you have to have what's called the property of the subject. The subject has to be the reason. That's the first thing you want to ascertain. Sound is a product. And then it has to have what's called the forward pervasion. Not perversion. Did I say that before? Not pervasion. not perversion. Forward pervasion. What is the forward pervasion? That means whatever is, sound is impermanent because it's a product. Whatever is impermanent has to be a product, has to be pervaded by being a product. Does that happen to be true? That's true. Remember, we went over this before. Even though being impermanent and being a product are synonyms, they appear differently to the mind, so one can be used as a reason to prove the other. Very incredibly interesting to my mind anyway, that point. So the third, usually we say that there are these three modes. Any correct reason has to have these, what they call the sulsum in Tibetan, these three modes. There has to be the property of the subject, so the subject has to be with the reason, has to have the reason. There has to be the forward pervasion, that is, whatever the predicate is, has to be pervaded by being the reason. So the reason occurs in two of these things. And then there has to be the reverse pervasion. And that is that the sign is never found in the opposite of the predicate. So we can forget about this one because that one will be automatically proved just having the forward pervasion. So generally all we have to have in a correct logical reasoning for it to be a correct reason is the property of the subject. The subject has to be the reason, and whatever the predicate is, the middle element, has to be pervaded by being the reason. So here, in the logical demonstration that sound is impermanent because it is a product of causes, the reason being a product of causes is a property of sound. And it is an exclusive characteristic of all impermanent phenomena. Whatever is impermanent is necessarily pervaded by being a product. And it is never a quality of things that are permanent. Okay. Is this your first introduction to this? Is this the first time you've heard this? You've heard this before. Anyone has never heard this before? Okay. A good number. Okay. Cecilia, have you heard this before? Yeah. Okay. Jordan, have you heard this before? Okay. So a little bit complicated at first. So this is very useful because sometimes you see the monks or you see pictures of people debating. They're always debating about logical subjects like this. Some kind of logical statement. One of the technical terms that's used is syllogism, although that syllogism, I think, comes up in Greek logic also and may have slightly different meaning, but we call this kind of statement where you have a subject, a predicate, which you're trying to prove these two things together, like a sound is impermanent. Why? You don't just leave it there because this is supposed to be some kind of logical demonstration. You give some reason because of something. That third thing is called the sign or reason. You have a subject, a middle element, which has different names. You can call it the predicate. Those two together, the subject and the predicate, are called the thesis, what you're trying to prove. Sound is impermanent. And then the third thing is called the reason or sign. The sign makes sense to you? Is it kind of a meaning, a synonym of reason? I don't mean like a sign on the street, you know, like a traffic sign. But like, for instance, you're going through the forest and, one of these movies where the trackers are trying to find something and say, there's a sign, they went that way, the branch is broken. You ever watch those kind of movies? Do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, okay. So sign in that sense, some kind of indication that is a reason, okay? So that is something that can lead to an inferential cognition where you know something unambiguously, but with correct belief, because there's some fault in your line of reasoning, or you have no reason at all, you can only presume something to be true. You can only believe it to be true. Even if it happens to be true, it's not really valid, your understanding. Anything which is not based on sound reasoning, that is not valid, won't lead you into deeper understanding. If you try to base the rest of your practice on that or the rest of some kind of logical arguments, it's like basing it on trying to build a building on a foundation which is you haven't put in the cement pillars, you know. Here in this building, I remember Hupcheng and I the other day were talking. We were here when this ground was consecrated by Geshe. What was his name? Who is it? No, yeah, Am Khunjuk was here maybe, but it was the teacher at the time, Geshe Dawala, Venerable Daochom is meditating at his monastic rooms at Sarah College nowadays. So Geshe Dawa did a ceremony on this land to consecrate, and then they had to put in, what did we do, put in kind of pillars when you build in this part of town? Was it? Columns? P-I-L. P-I-L-E. Oh, piles. Yeah. Piles, okay. So if you were to try to build a building here as tall as this and heavy as this, without having put the piles down first. You know, even the first floor might have stayed up. If you try to build up something more, it's not going to be stable. It could even collapse and so forth. So if you don't have a correct basis, even if you have a correct belief, even you believe something which happens to be true as the basis for your practice, that's not going to lead to long-term success in building on, you know, and understanding further. So this is very important to understand. So the first kind of correct belief is one that's based on no reason at all. Just hearing sound is impermanent. And you say, yeah, okay. You know, or, you know, past and future lives exist. Oh, yeah, okay. Probably much of our understanding comes about through, and most of what we understand now has come about through simply hearing or reading the teachings. And, you know, because it's supposed to be an authoritative book, or because we hear it from some lamas or from some teacher, supposedly they know the subject, we believe that. What we have heard happens to be correct, that we may develop a correct belief. That may be a correct belief. But we may not have any reason for understanding that. Okay. So the example, another kind of correct belief is one which is such as this. Sound is impermanent because it is non-functional. That's the one that I gave before. Because it is not arisen from causes and conditions. That's a contradictory reason. Because being non-functional, not developing from causes and conditions, is the Sautrantika definition of something that's permanent, such as space. So that's actually contradictory. So I will go over it next time. I will go over a couple of these others before we go on to the next one. But let me just introduce the next of the seven ways of knowing, which is this inattentive perception, or a consciousness to which an object appears, but the object is not ascertained. Here, ascertained means you don't have the capacity to generate later a memory. An ascertaining consciousness is one that's able to induce a memory of it, if you've ascertained something. Usually, if you see something, you hear something, you taste something, you can have a memory of that later. But in inattentive perception, or another way of calling it, is a perception to which an object appears but is not ascertained. That means, say for instance, the example of hearing something, not paying sufficient attention to it. So later you can't induce a memory. That the force of having appeared to your consciousness was not enough. It has to be paid sufficient attention to for you to remember it. What you do remember is the fireworks, let's say in Chinatown or in the Marina Bay and the different times of year, the different New Year's. Is there a third New Year here? Is it the Western New Year? Because you were thinking when I said New Year, you were just thinking Chinese New Year. And there's Chinese New Year, a different time. Is there a Muslim New Year? When is that generally? Or is it? Can you sort of calculate it? Or when does that take place? Does anyone know? It's not a big celebration here in Singapore. Come again? June this year. It'll be the Muslim New Year. So the different kinds of New Years. I'm not sure if they have fireworks at that time or not. So inattentive perception is a way of knowing that when an objective entity that appears clearly to one of your types of consciousness yet you are inattentive of it. So there are three kinds, three varieties. You can have inattentive perception of the sense consciousness, you know, hearing, seeing, smelling. How could you be inattentive of something that appears to your eye consciousness? Well, maybe you're thinking of something. Has that ever happened to you? You know, you're thinking of something, and maybe there's an accident in front of you, and then you say, what happened? You just hear the crash, it wakes you out of your thinking. You can be inattentive of odors. My sense of smell is still enough. If I smell durian, doesn't remain inattentive. But some odors, maybe later someone said, did you smell that sewer smell? And you may have been paying, maybe you're a person who is in, you know, checking some room to see if the dimensions are correct, and you're so concentrated on that, you don't pay attention to what the nose consciousness is perceiving. There's some odor appearing, but it is not ascertained by your mental consciousness because you're distracted by something else. So there's three kinds of inattentive perception. That in the bare sensory perceptions, in the bare mental perception, say, for instance, when we are watching our mind, there can be things that can be appearing to your mental consciousness, but because you're focusing on one of these thoughts, some of the other thoughts that are very subtle can go unnoticed. They can be inattentive to your mental perception. Remember we said there were... how many kinds of perception did we say there were before? Do you remember? We briefly mentioned it. We said there are sense perceptions, mental direct perception, yogic direct perception, did we mention? Do you remember that? And what was the other one? Did you say? Self-knowing perception. So a quality of a perception can be, in any kind of consciousness, can be an awareness of the fact that you are knowing. It's called self-perception or reflexive perception. So there can be some reflexive or self-knowing perceptions that are inattentive. But yogic direct perceptions, that one of the categories, is never inattentive because it's so focused. It's based on a combination of tranquil abiding, calm abiding, and penetrative insight. It knows its object continually and is never inattentive to it. Okay. So we'll go over these same subjects. I'll review again a little bit about correct belief next time, and then go on to inattentive perception, and then go on to some of the other ones after that. If we had more time, we could go into the details. The text gives examples of these different things that come from some classical examples in the Buddhist literature, but we won't have time to go into all of those examples now. How do you feel? Is it a lot for your mind? My teacher, Geshe Zopa, when he would teach in the summer courses, he would go into great detail. He would teach some of the great Tibetan Buddhist texts, one by a Lama Tsongkhapa called Gompa Rapsel. There's a commentary on Chandrakirti. Very, very... Geshe said, now we're going to be chewing dry bones. You know, like, you don't get a lot of enjoyment immediately, you know. But maybe nutritionally speaking, if you're chewing those dry bones, you can get down to the marrow and the cartilage around. You get a lot of nutrition, you know. So this course is for some of you, this might be like chewing dry bones. Okay, I'll come in a second. But don't worry. Great, great benefits to exercising your mind, hearing these things now, not being completely clear about things. Discuss it. If you know a couple of the people in the class, discuss it with them. Think about it on the MRT. Is that how you say it? MRT. When you're at work occasionally, rather than watching videos of kitty cats on your phone, you know, you can try to recall these different things and see if they make sense. And if you have doubts, write them down and ask questions. So you have a question or a comment. Nice and loud. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Chaitanya, yeah.
Mentioned, right? So my question is whether Chaitanya is memory itself or Chaitanya has to refer to memory in order to cognize the object.
In order to talk nice to the object?
Cognize the object.
Oh, cognize. Yeah. I thought you said in order to talk nice to, in order to cognize. So Chaitanya is not memory. Memory happens to be a Chaitanya, a secondary mental factor. There's a mental factor called smirti or dhamma. What is it in Pali? You know it, sati. Like we say satipatthana. Have you heard of the Satipatthana Sutra? It was a close placement of mindfulness or memory. So here's an example of these pervasions. Memory is a mental factor. Secondary mental factor. It's not a primary mind. It's a quality of consciousness that knows some particularity about the perceptual field. But not all chitanas are memory. It is just one of that large group. Okay, is one of the many kinds of mental factors. So now, no. Having said that, say your question again. See, does your question change now, or is your question answered?
Somehow it's answered.
Is it sort of answered?
Yeah.
Okay.
So can I ask a second question?
You can.
Later?
Yeah. As long as people don't object. We're just at 9:30, and I should have left some time for questions. Is it okay if we go over a couple minutes? If anyone has to leave to catch particular bus or train, feel free. Is it whenever you leave? You don't bow to me, but bow to the Buddha, and it's understandable. But yeah, continue.
The second question is actually a very practical question.
Say again. I didn't catch.
Okay. The second question is actually a practical question.
Okay.
I think many of us want to know. As we age, we somehow lose our memory. And to the extent that people completely forget who they are. So as we practice our path in Buddhism and things like that, what happened, what will be your advice if we reach that stage? We've been a pious Buddhist, doing all our chanting, puja, and practice, and learning dhammas, and our memories start to deteriorate as we age.
My experience, I just finished a retreat this last year, in July, just at the beginning of July last year. A three-year, three-month retreat. And I found, before the retreat was starting, I was noticing, because I'm 73 now, and I was beginning to notice, you know, a little short-term memory, you know, couldn't remember things, but meditating every day, with some, you know, even though I'm lazy, with a little bit of intensity, more than usual, that my memory improved. In the short-term memory, what was seeming like losing some short-term memory was, again, back to normal. And I could remember more things, long-term memory also. So I think, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, let's say from the Western perspective, first of all, there are some there are pathways within our brain which act as stores of memory for short-term memory, where you can remember things quickly. it's kind of like, you know what, in computers, you know the difference between RAM and the hard drive? Okay, I don't mean the old spinning hard drive. I mean, like, let's say the solid-state drives now, okay? So RAM sometimes is kind of like short-term memory. In fact, they even say random access memory, right? Do you know what I'm talking about? Okay, maybe some of you don't know anything about computers, but this is Singapore, you must know. Okay. Yeah. And you're so the best country for math and science and everything. So, you know, the brain, in a sense, has a capacity to act a little bit like RAM. Our mental, from a Buddhist perspective, our mental consciousness can recall things independent of the brain. But we rely very much, and because we haven't developed our mental consciousness sufficiently, we can't remember things sometimes, because if the brain begins to have some kind of I'm not sure what it's called in Alzheimer's, is they've started to realize there's certain deposits of certain elements in the brain that can be either genetic or caused by other factors that can bring upon old age dementia and Alzheimer's and other things where you lose your ability to from certain short-term memory and long-term memory and other kinds of things. But from a Buddhist perspective, those are still accessible through the mental consciousness. I believe that in so doing, by exercising the mind in meditation, you can start to even develop other pathways. And there are ways that people counter that they find this in Alzheimer's also, that over time through certain exercises, if a person no longer has the ability to walk because of some mental impairment, by walking very slowly and concentrating on every step, going again and again and again, repetition, they can start to develop new pathways to the motor areas of their brain, and then later they're able to. It's sort of like finding a detour. You know, the main highway has had an earthquake, and now you build some detour around that to get to the same destination. So I think the same thing applies in meditation. So I would say that those of us who are growing older, that my suggestion is to do some real serious meditation. Not just chanting. Chanting is very good because you create some virtuous karma, we can call merit, right? But what is more meritorious is if you understand the meaning of the words, you've actually meditated. You the verse that you chant, or the verses that you chant, you study, you understand every word, what is being said, and you meditate on that meaning. Like when you say, I go for refuge to the three rare supremacies, or the triple gem, the three jewels, the triratna. And when you say those words, we might just say them glibly in some chant along with other things. But if you actually meditate on taking refuge in the Buddha, what does it mean to take refuge in the Buddha? What does it mean to take refuge in the Dharma? That's the real refuge. What does it mean to take refuge in the Sangha? There's no, right nowadays, you know, there's some Western people and Tibetans and Chinese that are Sanghas, but you can't always take refuge in them. But it also means taking refuge in the Arya Sangha with their clairvoyance, who can actually aid you if you have faith. So understanding these things and meditating on them in detail, simply saying those words of the chant can bring back a remembering consciousness, can bring back a memory of having, just saying the words very briefly can bring back that memory consciousness of your meditation, and you accumulate so much more merit. Not only do you accumulate merit, you actually bring back that feeling. So my suggestion is to combine, you know, your practice with a lot of meditation, you know, understanding, hearing teachings, reading about it as we're doing now, contemplating that, and then meditating on that. And then your chanting will become more meaningful. And your memory will improve. Okay? Some last question before we call it a night? Okay. You don't want to ask it. Good. Okay. So this is not too long. It's only 7 minutes over. So let's just finish with a very brief dedication. Recognizing that we've created virtuous karma tonight, feeling some joy about that, rejoicing in that, even increases the intensity of that, feeling good. I haven't wasted my time tonight. Even though I've been chewing dry bones, you know, there's great, great benefit to this. This is what all of the great, you know, realized ones had to go through, you know, chewing these dry subjects at first, and then it becomes more tasty. I've created virtuous karma. May this karma ripen in such a way that it brings about my continued spiritual development from life to life. As a result of these merits, may I become eventually enlightened. May I become a Buddha. And from that stance, be able to spontaneously and effortlessly, totally correctly lead sentient beings out of suffering. You know, the enormous suffering that mother sentient beings are experiencing. Lead them out of that into that perfect state of Buddhahood as a result of these merits. Seeing that sequence, you know, trying to make a firm determination, a dedication, like setting aside your tax return for some noble cause. May these merits ripen in that way.